This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
جاهز محمد؟ محمد؟ نبدأ؟ الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين وبعد. So this is our third session, inshallah, on the maxims of fiqh. Just to have a bit more insight into the maxims of fiqh, because it's a dilemma, or most of the time, to translate the concept, because we have, although we spoke about the difference between usul al-fiqh and al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya. Usul al-fiqh are the foundations of fiqh, and these are basically the rules that show us how we deduce rulings from texts. How do we handle the texts? Okay, what are the general rules that govern the deduction process, which is how do we understand the texts in order to take from them rulings? So there are principles and there are parameters and there are guidelines that we should follow in order for our deduction, or the rulings that we extract from evidence, from textual evidence, to be correct and authentic. Al-Qawa'id al-Fiqhiyya is different, is completely different kind of science, although it's quite related. But it is more, as we said, general rules that seem to apply to a huge number or an endless number of fiqhi rulings. So they're basically more about patterns, general patterns that are noticeable in Sharia. That when you see Sharia, for example, you will see there is a very strong tendency towards ease, making things easy, making things more practical. So this is a general feature. So this is why this general feature was written down as a maxim, as one of the rules of fiqh. Some scholars like to call these maxims theories. Theories. Why? Because although some of them are based on evidence from the Qur'an and the Sunnah, some of them, even the very wording of them, is actually taken from the Qur'an and the Sunnah, but still they are a theory. It's a human effort to see what the general rules in Islam are. So this is why some of the scholars call them nadhariyat al-nadhariyat al-fiqhiyya. Al-nadhariyat al-fiqhiyya. They are actually theories. Fiqhi theories. Like in any discipline or any science, when you notice a recurring theme and it happens over and over again, say for example, lung cancer is more prevalent among smokers. When you make a study and you actually find a strong correlation between smoking and lung cancer, then you arrive at the conclusion that, you know, there is a strong link. So this is a general feature. Smoking tends to increase the possibility or the probability of someone getting lung cancer. So this is why some scholars call them al-nadhariyat al-fiqhiyya, fiqhi theories. This is more of a recent. It was widely used mainly by Sheikh Mustafa al-Zarqa, and then there was a complete study done by a very powerful scholar in that field, and is Fathi al-Duraini. He actually had a research called al-nadhariyat al-fiqhiyya, نظريات الفقهية. Talking about the history of al-qawa'id, or the maxims of fiqh, we said in the early times, the time of the Prophet ﷺ, the times of the companions of the Prophet ﷺ, some of those maxims or some of those theories were stated. Some of them are in the Quran. You'll find them clear there. For example, وَلَيْسَ اللَّهُ الْبَيْعَ وَحَرَّمَ الرِّبَا. So any transaction that meets the criteria of riba, of usury, then it is considered to be riba. Any transaction that falls naturally under buying and selling, then it's considered to be bay'. So the original state of any transaction is actually it's halal. Why? Because it's bay'. Unless we find out that it's more in line with a riba, then we consider it to follow that category, so it becomes haram. This is a general rule. Then you will find, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ بِكُمُ الْيُسْرَ وَلَا يُرِيدُ بِكُمُ الْعُسْرَ. Allah wants ease. Allah wants to bring ease
to you, Allah doesn't want to bring hardship. So this is, as well, this is a maxim. This is a fiqhi maxim. It's a theory. It's a recurrent theme throughout the Islamic rulings. And then we said from the Prophet ﷺ there are statements that were taken as general rules, like al-umuru, or like innama al-a'malu bin-niyyat. The actions are considered based on their intentions, which is basically became one of the main rules on the main maxims in fiqh. Then the companions of the Prophet ﷺ, there were some statements, some observations that they saw, so they made these statements and they became some kind of maxims. So that shows that the scholars of the early times, even afterwards the tabi'een, they were thinking in such a systematic way about fiqh. So they did not see fiqh as fragmented, as compartmentalized, as dispersed kind of rulings that are disconnected. No, they could see general themes running through Islam, general principles and phenomena that are running through all the rulings that we find in Islam. So these are general features, and they codified them in certain statements, and these statements became later on to be known al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya. So the early scholars, most of their thinking about fiqh and about Islam was actually run by this kind of understanding. This was in the background of their minds. They could see patterns. And today, any expert in any field, what actually sets them apart from others is this kind of systematic understanding. So they don't necessarily know each example or each case individually, but they know the general themes that run through this whole system. They know it, and they understand how these general themes govern that science or that discipline. So this is exactly how the early scholars were actually relating to fiqh. So they saw fiqh more as more systematic. And this is why a lot of the statements came from them. Like there are some who said, you will find a lot of the rulings or a lot of these maxims and theories are actually found in the early books of great scholars like Abu Yusuf al-Qadi in his book Al-Kharaj. In his book Al-Kharaj. Abu Yusuf al-Qadi, he became the main judge in the Abbasid Caliphate. Al-Khilaf al-Abbasiyya. He became the main judge. So, he wrote this book for governance, Al-Kharaj, for how to run taxation and how to run issues of general policy and governance. This is why he wrote the book, Al-Kharaj. He wrote it as a constitution to run the state in that aspect. So you will, when we mentioned last week some of the statements, some of the rulings, or some of the maxims in his book that are actually were taken as qawa'id fiqhiyya. So that shows you the systematic approach that the scholars always had to fiqh. Also, Al-Muhammad ibn al-Hasan al-Shaybani, in some of his books, you will find a lot of maxims. We mentioned Imam al-Shafi'i as well in his book Al-Umm. In his book Al-Umm, there were many maxims that were taken. For example, one of the maxims that we mentioned last week from his book Al-Umm was إِذَا ضَاقَ الْأَمْرُ اتَّسَعَ. If things become a bit tight, then Sharia will give about ease, will bring about ease. What does that mean? That means there will be concessions, there will be exemptions, there will be exceptions. So Sharia will bring about ease. If there is a difficult situation, then the Sharia will loosen its rulings there. So when someone is in necessity, some of the haram things will actually become halal. Why? In order to alleviate or remove completely the necessity or that condition completely. Towards the 4th century after Hijrah, and that means 300 something. During that 4th century, this is the time where taqleed became more rampant. Taqleed is more of a blind, there's less creativity among the scholars in terms of fiqh. There was less creativity. There was more about following earlier scholars and copying them. So most of the efforts of the fuqaha at that time was to take the literature and the contributions of the early scholars and try to classify them, explain them, expound upon them, but nothing substantially new was introduced into fiqh. So this is why it was considered by the scholars during this 4th century to be the beginning of a taqleed era, which is more of a stagnation, somehow a level of stagnation in fiqh. This actually allowed the scholars to try to codify the contributions of early scholars into maxims, into general rules. So they tried to figure out. And this actually helped support or helped give rise to the science of al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya to more into a distinct science. So among the earlier ones, we said last week as well, that the Hanafis were among the earliest scholars to start this kind of discipline with al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya. So we'll find, for example, one of their main scholars, al-Karkhi. Al-Karkhi, he wrote his book, which is Risalat al-Karkhi. Risalat al-Karkhi. And it was about these maxims, such maxims. And then we mentioned Abu Zayd al-Dabusi, also Hanafi. Abu Zayd al-Dabusi, he wrote a book called Ta'sis al-Nadhar. Ta'sis al-Nadhar, Abu Zayd al-Dabusi. This, principles, rules, maxims, theories about the, as we said, the general rules that seem to be running through the whole body of fiqh. Then afterwards, towards the 5th century, we have some other books started to appear as well. Other books started to appear, and specifically talking about qawa'id. So the title qawa'id became well established as maxims, and it became a specific science. So you will have scholars actually writing books on al-qawa'id. So we have, for example, al-Imam Ala'uddin Muhammad bin Ahmad al-Samarqandi. This is 540 after Hijrah. The year 540 after Hijrah. He wrote a book called Idahul Qawa'id, Explanation of the Maxims. Explanation of the Maxims. Towards the seventh century, which is 600 something, more books. This was more of a revival era for al-qawa'id. So there were more books written then. Amongst the most outstanding, the famous book of Izzuddin al-Izz bin Abd al-Salam, Izzuddin ibn Abd al-Salam, the Shafi'i scholar, Izzuddin ibn Abd al-Salam, or al-Izz ibn Abd al-Salam. He wrote one of the most beautiful books ever written in Islam. It's called Qawa'id al-Ahkam. Qawa'id al-Ahkam. مصالح الأنام. This book is among the most outstanding books in the history of Islam. Really so beautifully written, full of maxims, full of theories that are quite like enlightening when it comes to studying Islam. The Shafi'is excelled. During this time, the Shafi'is took the lead in terms of writing about Al-Qawa'id. Shafi'i, scholars of the Shafi'i madhab actually expanded their knowledge there, and they developed these qawa'id big time. So Al-Izz bin Abd al-Salam was a Shafi'i. There were other scholars as well who were Shafi'is, and you will find them in the English like text that we recommended. And inshallah, from next time we'll start reading. So I'll get one of these students, if anyone has like their laptop or tablet where they can actually read, help us, that would inshallah, because we said we're going to follow the old style of teaching, which is one of the students would be reading and they will be commenting on the text, and we'll be moving on like that inshallah. Al-Malikiyya also wrote some books, but as we said, the main thing was, or the ones who excelled were the Shafi'is. In the 8th century after Hijrah, which is 700 something, that was more books produced on Al-Qawa'id. So some of the books that are there, and I think you'll find some of them as well in the English book, there's Al-Ashbah wal-Nadha'ir li Ibn al-Wakil al-Shafi'i. Al-Ashbah wal-Nadha'ir. Al-Ashbah wal-Nadha'ir means things that are similar and things that are different. Similarities and differences. Similarities and differences. So these rules will mention so many cases that are identical, although on the surface they seem to be different. So these are al-ashbah. Al-nadha'ir, they are different. They might seem to be similar cases, but they're actually different, completely different cases. So the scholars of Qawa'id al-Fiqhiyya focused on these two aspects, the similarities that bring so many cases into under one rule, and they focused on certain fiqhi cases that seem to be similar on the surface, but they are actually different. So they would be telling and showing the differences, and they would be showing the similarities. So many books were written under the name Al-Ashbah wal-Nadhair, the similarities and the differences. The similarities and the differences, Al-Ashbah wal-Nadhair. So we'll have plenty of them. Ibn al-Wakil al-Shafi'i wrote a book under this title. Tajuddin al-Subki, one of the great scholars of Shafi'is, wrote a book on this. Jamaluddin al-Isnawi as well wrote a book on this. Badruddin al-Zarkashi as well. All of these are Shafi'is. Zarkashi wrote something else. It's not al-Ashbah al-Nadhair. But we have later on, we'll come to As-Suyuti, who's Shafi'i as well, he wrote Al-Ashbah wal-Nadhair. So, throughout that time, these centuries, a lot of these books started to come, and so it was more of codifying the madhahib under these maxims. Codifying the madhahib under these maxims in order to give them more system and more structure. So that's what these maxims actually do. They give structure to the madhab. They give structure. So instead of it being scattered fatawa and verdicts here and there, no, it became systematic. You could see the general rules. There's a general rules that apply almost everywhere. And we said there will always be exceptions, but these exceptions are a minority and they belong to a different rule. So the rules actually run across the board. So, inshallah, I will leave the details about these, you know, these books that were written during the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th centuries, that time, where a lot of books started to write specifically. The books that were written on al-qawa'id or on the maxims were fiqh specific. So we'll find the Shafi'is writing on Shafi'is. The Hanafis writing on Hanafi fiqh. The Malikis writing on Maliki fiqh. Hanbalis writing on Hanbali fiqh. That's it. So it's only in recent times that the scholars started to bring about all of these maxims together in one place and see the similarities among them. By the way, these maxims and rules are actually very practical, not only in fiqh, but even in life. They can give you guidelines even for life. They can shape and sculpt your way of thinking in a very practical fashion. Very practical fashion. And the reason is, Sharia or Islam and life, they're connected. They are connected. Islam is very practical. It's only sometimes some of its adherents, some of the people who hold on to it or try to teach it sometimes, that they actually have issues. But Islam itself is highly practical. It does not lose its essence or its ethics in order to condone reality or the status quo. No. But it recognizes and acknowledges the status quo or the reality, actual reality, and then it presents solutions that are practical to move reality or the actual reality to a better place. That's what Sharia is. So let's take some examples that really clarifies these things. So one of these are things that just crossed my mind now, to show you how these fiqhi or maxims are actually very powerful. The scholars say, في أوقات الرخاء يغلب العدل وفي أوقات الفتنة يغلب الفضل. At the times of ease and tranquility, that means when truth is established, we give precedence to justice. We give precedence to justice. For example, someone took, or you had a transaction with someone, or some kind of a project partnership with someone, and a dispute happened. You actually chase it until you get your right. You chase it until you get your right, and the person gets their right. So no one you know, takes an advantage of the other one. ولكن في أوقات الفتنة يغلب الفضل. So at the times of fitna, times of trial, times of turmoil, what do? That's for your personal dealings. You give precedence to forgiveness. So you might overlook some of your rights. So you have adl, you have fadl. You have adl, which is justice. Exactly, you get your right, I get my right. But fadl means you're gonna overlook some of your rights. That's during the turmoil times. Why? Because chasing justice is very difficult at times of fitna, and it could lead to greater evil. You could easily put your life at risk for the sake of chasing your right. So this is why Uthman ibn Affan, what did the scholars take some of this, like some of the examples of this? Uthman ibn Affan radiallahu anhu, when he was the Khalifa, and some of the Khawarij, they came and surrounded Medina, and then surrounded his house. The companions wanted to fight them, right? And protect. He said, no, don't protect my house. They even came and killed him, and he did not defend himself. Why? Because he knew that this is a time of fitna. This is a time of fitna. If he were to fight, these people pretended to be Muslims. And they were actually Muslims, but they were on a corrupt understanding. And they were as well, the strings were pulled by some external forces. Uthman ibn Affan, he did not treat them with justice, with adl. He treated them with what? Fadl. So he did not fight them in Medina. Why? Because he did not want to create a fight among the Muslims. He said, I don't want to be the cause of Muslims shedding the blood of other Muslims. So he even sacrificed his life for that. Ali ibn Abi Talib radiallahu anhu was frustrated. He said, you know, why are you stopping us from defending you? From defending your house, pushing these people away? Because these people set a siege around the house of the Khalifa. That was a very turbulent time. Ali ibn al-Khattab got frustrated to the extent that he wanted to leave Medina. He said, like, I feel helpless because I want to defend the Khalifa, but the Khalifa has given us commands and orders not to, not to create any dispute with these guys. So that's at the time of fitna, you treat people with fadl. So you might overlook some of your rights. Someone might wrong you, you let it go. You let it go. Why? Because you're trying to preserve a greater benefit. Because sometimes you might have a dispute or fight over a small right of yours where you're actually causing a greater kind of evil to bring about, to come about. So you need to be careful. Another one of the maxims generally, the scholars say, al-mu'amalatu aw al-nikahu mabniyun ala al-musamaha. والمعاملات مبنية على المشاحة. Dealings, transactions, dealing with people. If it's about nikah, if it's about marriages, it's built upon forgiveness. It's not give and take. Don't make it give and take. Yeah, there is an element of give and take, but be lenient there. Be easygoing. But when it comes to transactions, business, مبني على المشاحة. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Right? Give and take. It's all about rights. So the scholars have differentiated. They found this pattern in rulings in Islam when it comes to marriage. When it comes to marriage, there's a lot of leniency. There is a lot of wiggle room, right? We're not so adamant. These are my rights. You need to give me my rights. No? Because it's about preserving the family. It's about human interaction. So there's a lot of space. A lot of space to accommodate. Accommodate. Okay, you pull a little bit and you let loose a little bit in order for this life to continue, this marriage to continue. But when it comes to business, it's about rights. It's about, we can't like have partnership. I put 50%, you put 50%. When profits come, you take 70% and you give me 30%. We say no. In business, it's about transaction. You go and buy something, okay, and there's no price on it. Sometimes you have to, you know, argue about the price. You have to argue about the price specifically. Like now, it's a lot of these things are priced already. That's one price. But like in different countries, if you don't argue over the price, I mean, you're going to pay double the price, maybe or triple the price. So you need to be careful. So this is as well, you'll find this in Islam, in Sharia. It's all about, when you find transactions, it's all about everyone getting their right. But when it comes to marriage, yes, there is the foundation of rights and obligations, but we are more easygoing there. We're not so specific. Now imagine a husband is saying, like, he's chasing his wife all the day, that's my right, that's my right. These are my rights. You can't do this, you can't do that, that's my right, that's my right. That's not even a life. Or the wife is chasing her husband. He wants to, let's say for example, someone calls him at 10 o'clock, listen, I'm stuck on the highway, I need your help. His wife says, that's my right, you stay here. It's my friend, he's in trouble. He hasn't got road assistance. So I need to help him, he's stuck. He says, no, these are my rights, you have to give me my rights, these are your obligations, stay at home. Things don't work like this in a marriage. So some of the rulings, let's take some of them from that are actually very, very practical as well, that we can see the practicality there. As I said, these are taken from people who have studied Islam, studied the rulings, and they have seen these patterns or these patterns, they found them to be consistent, everywhere consistent, whether you're dealing with Hajj, you're dealing with Salah, these are consistent across the board. For example, one of the of these maxims, إِنَّ الْمَقْدُورَ لَا يَسْقُطُ بِالْمَعْجُوزِ عَنْهُ. إِنَّ الْمَقْدُورَ لَا يَسْقُطُ بِالْمَعْجُوزِ عَنْهُ. You know, what a person is capable to do is not waived because of something else he cannot do. That needs explanation. What does that mean? المقدور لا يسقط بالمعجوز عنه. Someone owes you $10,000. He's incapable. Now he's financially stuck, incapable, his case is completely helpless. But he can pay you $3,000. He has $3,000, he can pay. Can the judge say, let's settle the payment? Okay? I mean, that's what he can pay you, $3,000. Would you like it? Take it or leave it. Let's settle this once and for all. We say no. If he can give $3,000, he gives $3,000, and $7,000 stays, it's pending. He has to pay it. That's an outstanding debt. Whenever he can pay it, he should pay it. It does not get waived. It does not get waived. Someone, for example, is unable to stand up during the prayer. They had surgery in their back. They had surgery in their back. So what do? They cannot stand up, but they can make ruku'ah. And that's an issue with people sometimes. So they cannot stand up, but they can make ruku'ah. Or they can make sujood. Let's say that's more specific. They can make sujood. So prostration, they can make it. So he says, okay, I can't stand up, so what do? I pray on the chair. So when the imam says Allahu Akbar, he's behind the imam, and he's Allahu Akbar on his chair. He makes ruku' on his chair. And then the problem with a lot of these people, they make sujood as well on the chair. But you can make sujood, right? He can get off his chair and go and make sujood. No issues, no harm on his back. Here, al-maqdur, أو المقدور عليه لا يسقط بالمعجوز عنه. What this person is able to do does not get waived because there's something else he cannot do. So he cannot stand up, okay, during salah, that's fine, that's waived. But that doesn't mean everything else in salah is waived as well. Like in sujood as well, خلاص, just leave it, do it on the chair. No. You can do sujood, you do sujood. Is that clear? So that's as well. These are examples. We're taking examples because, you know, taking so much theory, sometimes it could be so abstract, and this might be problematic in understanding. النادر ملحق بالعدم. النادر ملحق بالعدم. That's a beautiful rule. Things that are rare, like rare occurrences, should be treated as what would be the word? Al-adam. Yeah, but what would be a good way to put it? So, rarities are treated as rarities are should be treated the same way impossibilities are, or okay, it's not impossible. There is a word, but somehow it's not coming up. Okay, so rare cases, okay, are treated like cases that won't happen, like impossibilities. What would be an example of this, or some practical application of this? Let's say, I'm trying to think, find a good example there. That النادر ملحق بالعدم. Yes, let's say someone is selling a product. Someone is selling a product. They found out, out of, let's say there's, now the government wants to make other, like, condone this product or create a ban on it. This product, it's a health product. In 1,000 cases, one out of each 1,000, it creates some side effects, negative side effects. When 1,000 people take it, in one case, it creates negative side effects. It creates negative side effects. Now, should the government condone this or not? This rule here applies. Since there is great benefit for this product, and you know, one case out of 1,000 is a rarity, isn't it? That's a rare case. So we treat it as nothing. We treat it as nothing there. This is how the general ruling applies there. Let's say someone wants to make wudu. Someone wants to make wudu. And they say, okay, I want to use, for example, let's say spring water. Let's say there's a creek. I want to make wudu in that creek. But in that province, let's say there is about 10,000 creeks. And because there used to be some factories in certain areas, some of those are actually polluted and filthy. Polluted and filthy, and the water has become impure. But a normal person cannot tell if that water is pure or not. They cannot tell. So I'm in that province, I want to make wudu. So maybe there are 10 cases or 20 creeks out of 10,000 that are polluted, but we don't know where they are. We don't know where they are exactly. So this creek that I'm making wudu from could be one of those. But 10 out of, or 20 out of a 10,000, that's a rarity, that's a small thing, insignificant. So how do we treat it? We treat it that it's pure, forget it, don't investigate. As simple as that, okay? Anyway, so there are many other rules, but these are just examples that hopefully... Do you see, these are actually practical. They help you even deal with... like someone says, should I buy an iPhone or a Samsung phone? Well, how many faulty devices there are? Plenty, right? Out of, let's say, 10,000, at least you'll find 50, probably they say, or 100 are actually faulty. But you still go and buy it. You take your chances. Why? Because it's a rarity. It's impractical. It doesn't make sense for me to dismiss a whole thing like this just because of a very minute possibility that something could go wrong. So this is also logical, you could see. So this shows as well the logical side and within the that's running through the Islamic rulings. Okay, let's move on. That's a good one as well, to take it as an example. الإذن العرفي بطريق الوكالة كالإذن اللفظي. الإذن العرفي بطريق الوكالة كالإذن اللفظي. It's a very important one. This is a ضابط, by the way. Remember we explained the different categories of maxims? This is ضابط. It's very specific. It's very specific. It's taken from the general قاعدة or general maxim, which is العادة محكمة. العادة محكمة أو العرف. العرف. What does that mean? That means the norms of the people. The norms of the people. Let's say in one country, if the general understanding of the people, that if a police officer stops you, police officer stops you, and he says, or he gives you a ticket. If you do not contest or make an objection on the spot, that automatically means you accepted it. Okay? That's a general rule that people... This is how the system has been working. So someone was stopped by a police officer and they were given a ticket. And they did not contest it. Now he goes to a judge. Let's say that's a Muslim country, okay? He goes to a judge and he says, he gave me a ticket, but I did not consent to it. The judge would say, since you've grown up in this country, you're a resident of this country, you know the norms in this country, you know that saying nothing is actually an approval. So you have approved to it, so you have to pay it. You see, this happens a lot in business. In a lot of businesses, sometimes, like in an auction, someone makes a bid. In that auction, the urf, the general rule has become, this is how the norm has developed over years, is that if you make a bid and for 20 seconds, no one makes another bid, it falls on you. You get the deal. So let's say you made a bid and 20 seconds passed, no one made a bid, it's yours. This product is yours and you can't pull out of it now. You can't pull out of it. It's a deal, it's an agreement. But you might say, well, I did not make an agreement. I did not say, listen, I'm going to buy this and I can't pull out. You can't say this. Why? Because this is a general rule. This is how the system has been running. So we have to understand this. These are important things. So what does this mean sometimes? Things that are not stated, if this is how things have been running all the way, if you engage in that system, you are bound by it. Even though you haven't made a statement, if a certain gesture or a certain stance that you take has, for example, legal or financial consequences and implications, you are bound by them. This is why the power of al-urf. Okay? In certain areas in the Muslim country, although it's not a recommended practice, but like if two families get together, one family asks for the daughter of the other family, for their son. Some of those, they recite al-Fatiha. In some of these countries, the recitation of Al-Fatiha signifies ijab and qabul, signifies acceptance. Basically, if the father of the boy or the young man says, okay, we want your daughter in marriage. If the, although this is disputed by the way, by the scholars, because in marriage it has to be stated, but the scholars would still take this. If the father of the daughter said, let's recite Al-Fatiha. For them, this is a statement of acceptance. This is how it's been running through this country. Although we don't recommend this practice, but we're saying these are sometimes the scholars. So later on, if the father of the daughter pulls out of the marriage, the judge will say, but you gave your word. So if you want to pull out of the marriage, it becomes khul', not divorce. So there are consequences. Okay. So the urf, the norms of the people, how people understand things, okay, gestures, words, how they apply, then all of these are binding. They are binding. And once you enter into the system, you are part of it. Okay? We'll carry on, inshallah, after salah. Salah wa salam alayhi wa sallam alayhi wa sallam alayhi wa sallam wa iyaakum.
الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين وبعده. Let's take some a bit more maxims or قواعد that are actually beneficial and helpful. I want to give you a bit more exposure to the قواعد الفقهية before we delve into the main ones, الكلية, the more inclusive ones. We have, for example, لا واجب مع عجز ولا حرام مع ضرورة. There is no obligation with inability, and there is no haram or impermissibility with necessity. That's the general rule. What does it mean? If someone is incapable of doing something in Islam, someone is incapable of fasting, physically is unable to fast, there's no obligation. He doesn't fast. But there's a kaffara, there's an expiation. Someone says, no, fasting is an obligation, you have to. This is not from Islam. So when there is inability, there is no obligation in Islam. لا واجب مع عجزين. Someone is incapable, say, oh, when you pray, you have to stand up. Qiyam. Someone cannot stand up. You can't force them to stand up. It loses the level of wajib or obligation upon them. So they have a concession. When there is inability, there is no obligation. And when there is necessity, there is no haram. There's no haram. Someone, in order to survive, the only way for them to do, as we said, the only thing available is to eat something haram. That's the only way for them to survive. Otherwise, most likely they would die. That makes the haram here permissible. There's nothing about haram here. Again, like an issue happened here in the masjid months ago. A brother came with a question. He said, I came to the masjid and the first line was full. The first line was full. So I walked in, and there was another brother who entered into the musalla area with me at almost the same time. So I told him, okay, you take that left, that spot. There was one spot left at the end of the first row. I told him, you take it, I'm going to stand in the second line. He said, no. So he walked with me to the second line, and he left that spot open or vacant, and he stood up with me. I remember in that salah, I heard some people speaking, for a period of time, and it seemed to be like a heated argument. But after the salah, so this brother said, he told me that I came in, and there was this guy as well, at the same time. I told him, you take this spot, I will start a new line. But he said to me, no, you can't start a line by yourself. Your salah will be invalid. So I told him, but that's fine. I mean, there's no other choice. He said, no. So we kept arguing for a few seconds until finally he just joined me in the second line, and that's it. We prayed. So he came and asked me. I said, okay, let's not deal with it personally. Generally speaking, if someone comes, the first line is, or first row is complete, they can start a second line. No problem. They can pray by themselves in the second line. Someone comes and joins them, that's better. But if no one joins them, they can still pray a line by themselves. They make a line by themselves and they complete their prayer normal. There's nothing wrong. Now that other brother overheard this and he said, where did you get this from? Straight away. I said, you calm down, that's not how the way we deal with these things. But he says, no. The Prophet ﷺ says, Salatul Faddi, he said the hadith in English, but he's referring to the hadith, Salatul Faddi خلف الصف لا تصح. أو لا صلاة للفردي وراء الصف خلف الصف. That person making a line by himself behind the row is unacceptable. I told him, yes, the hadith is there, but the hadith doesn't indicate what you're talking about in this case here. The scholars have differed about this, and the majority of the scholars say, no, he can stand up in the line by himself when there's no other way, there's no other choice.
He says, where's the scholars who say that? Okay, that's not the way that we discuss fiqh. That's not a fight. So there are scholars. He said, Shaykh Ibn Baz said this and this and this. Fine, no problem. So I said, listen, I'm not going to get into this. The brother asked the question, I answered the question regardless. And we said it's not personal. But, so, anyway, the issue is that sometimes people don't understand what's going on. So there was a group of brothers who were sitting at the back, and then these brothers actually were, they saw the whole thing, and they built a narrative around this. They said the brother had a point. He mentioned a hadith, and they said the imam, he just said there's a difference among the scholars. But they said that's not what Islam, we have hadith, there's no issue of difference among the scholars. Subhanallah, that's our dilemma these days. People have learnt a little bit, and then they want to make rulings. That's the issue. Now, when the scholars differ, the difference of the scholars doesn't go against the hadith. A lot of people have evil thoughts about our scholars. I don't know where they got it from. A lot of people, like they follow a certain scholar, yeah, because that's the best of their ability, that's the best of their knowledge. Then you say, yeah, well, this scholar says this, but the hadith says something else. Do you think the scholars, and most likely these scholars know about this hadith, do you think these scholars would on purpose go against the hadith? Or do you think you have more knowledge than these scholars, that you know what the hadith means, they don't know? Now, if a scholar was speaking, I would say, yes, I mean, you're a scholar, you're entitled to your opinion. You are such a high caliber, fine, you can say, this scholar made a mistake. I would take that. But for someone like me and someone like you, general Muslims, let's know our limits. We should know our limits. So the issue in this case is that the scholars have differed about this. Why? Because they said if someone comes and they find no space in the row and they have to make a row by themselves, what other option do they have? There's no other option. So we apply here the rule, لا واجب مع عجز. So someone, it's obligatory upon them to be in the line with someone else. But there's no someone else. I'm by myself. And this happens. You come in, after the imam had already started, and you come, the first row is full, there's no place for you to squeeze in. So you find yourself stuck. You're going to wait for someone else? Or somebody says, you pull someone from the first line. But the scholars have explained, there are some scholars who hold this opinion, by the way, but the scholars have explained, they say, you have cut off a line. And that's haram. That's haram. For a line to be complete and then you make it incomplete. You cannot do this. And this has never been narrated from the Prophet ﷺ or the companions that they pulled someone from a line. So what do? You have no other option. Just pray. That's the only option you can. Or you still keep waiting until the imam finishes his salah and no one shows up. And obviously that's worse than you praying behind the line. So alhamdulillah, the majority of the scholars say, no, you establish a line by yourself and you pray. Someone joins you later on, fine. They don't join you, there's nothing wrong with your salah. Why? Because لا واجب مع عجز. There's no obligation upon you if there's inability. I can't create someone and put them next to me to make a line. Okay? So we need to, you know, sometimes someone learns a hadith or learns a verse and they think they know where it applies. No, you need to know there are other hadith, there are other principles that everything works in context. You need to see how they work together. That's the only way we can understand Sharia. Otherwise, it's easy for someone to, oh, that's a ruling, that's a hadith, and then you go everywhere. Islam doesn't work like this at all. We saw that the scholars have always had these guidelines. They saw Islam as systematic. There is this beautiful system that runs through it. Okay. So this, again, someone does not find water to make wudu. Or for some reason they have an illness in their skin that they should not touch moist or water. You can't pray without wudu. Do you say, no, you have to make wudu? No, you don't have. If you are incapable of using water now for wudu, you do tayammum. لا واجب مع عجزٍ. When there is inability, there is no wajib. The obligation is waived. Okay, so these are important. Like, so these are some examples. Again, That's a beautiful maxim as well, and that's a good exposure to get. ما حرم سدا للذريعة أبيح للمصلحة الراجحة. This is taken from إعلام الموقعين ابن القيم. This is a maxim, a قاعدة. That's very general as well. ما حرم سدا للذريعة أبيح للمصلحة الراجحة. What is it? How do we translate it? Things that are haram in Islam are two types. محرم لذاته. Things that are haram because of themselves. Zina is haram because of itself. It is haram. The act of zina is haram. The act of zina itself is haram. Riba, it in itself is haram. But there are things that are made in Islam haram, although they might be a little bit good. There might be some goodness in them, but they were made haram because they lead to a greater haram. And this is called muharramun لِغَيْرِهِ or muharram سَدًّا لِلذَّرِيعَ. Muharram سَدًّا لِلذَّرِيعَ. For example, a man dealing with a woman. In any human interaction, you need to look into the person's face, right? Normal human interaction, you look in their face, they look in your face. Now, but Islam made looking at women haram. For a man to look at like a stranger woman, haram. Why? Because this is likely to awake within himself the desire. The desire for maybe a relationship. This has an impact on him. So when someone looks, stares at a woman, basically that awakens their sexual desires. And it might create human emotional attachment. So this is why Islam made lowering the gaze an obligation. So he made looking at women who are foreign to you haram. Why? Because it could lead to zina. It could lead to emotional attachment. But when there is a benefit, a maslaha, there are instances where you can actually look at a woman. You can look at a woman. And not only her face, you can try to look at as much as possible, as much as you can, look at her. Why? If you want to marry her. You want to marry a woman, she's still a foreigner to you. The Prophet ﷺ says, فَلْيَنْظُرْ إِلَى مَا يَدْعُوهُ إِلَى نِكَاحِهَا. Let the person who wants to marry a woman, let him look at whatever could get him to marry her. What does that mean? If you manage to see this woman, obviously not sneak into houses or private places, but if you happen to see this woman, even without her scarf, she happened to be visiting, maybe she's your sister's friend, she happened to be in your house, okay? She happened to be in that room. She doesn't know that you could see her, and you really want to marry her. You can look at her hair. You can look at her without a scarf. Do you say, oh, no, looking at a woman is haram? No, if you have an intention to marry her, and you just want to see if she's the kind of person that you would marry, you can look at her. Why? Because there's a greater benefit that two people get in marriage, in a marriage. So in Islam, whatever is made haram. For example, now the issue of photography. Scholars like, this is a debate among scholars. Is it really a taswir or is it not? Even the scholars who say taswir is haram, they say photography is haram. There are some scholars who hold this opinion. They say photography is haram. These scholars themselves, they say, when there is a benefit, like for example, having an ID, you need your photograph there. A passport, you need it there. So because you need it, and because it's beneficial, governments can still use that. Why? Because it's needed, there is benefit to recognize people. Otherwise, fraud is possible. People could hijack hijack someone else's identity, and so on and so forth. So even these scholars, they say photography is haram, but when there is a need for it, that's fine. Not even a necessity, but a need. Okay? So, muharram لذاته is something that's haram by itself. It becomes only halal in times of necessity. Things that are haram because they lead to something haram, muharram لغيره, or muharram سدًا للذريعة, this becomes halal when there is haja, when there is a need. Not necessarily necessity. There is a need. Okay? So these are, again, these are examples of these maxims. We're not going to get more details, but I want you to, as you read through the book, and the book as well is Legal Maxims of Islamic Jurisprudence. This is published by Mishkat University. Okay, Legal Maxims of Islamic Jurisprudence. You need to download the book. You need to read the most significant books in that field. You need to read the most significant books. We mentioned previously the Risalat al-Karkhi, Ta'sis al-Nadhar by al-Dabusi, Abu Zayd al-Dabusi. These are important ones. Izzuddin or Al-Izz bin Abd al-Salam, Qawa'id al-Ahkam. This is very important. And others. These are Hanafis, and there are other madhahib as well. So you'll find a lot of them here. Each madhab, they put their books that are actually on Qawa'id that follow each madhab. And then inshallah, I think it's time for us inshallah to start getting into the qawaid, because we want to get into the qawaid. So we said there are al-qawaid, there's al-qawaid al-kulliyya al-kubra. Al-qawaid al-kulliyya al-kubra. What did we call them in English? What was the name they gave in English to them? Al-qawaid al-kulliyya al-kubra. Okay. They are normative legal maxims. Normative legal maxims. The scholars have agreed on 5 or 6. Okay? 5 or 6. These 5 or 6 apply across the board everywhere. These are normative legal maxims. They are inclusive and they apply everywhere. They are agreed upon by all the madhahib, and you will find them running through Islam wherever you go. So these are the main 5 or main 6. So next week we'll start dealing with them one after the other. So this is the main substance of the course. This is the main substance. Everything else was an introduction. So we will take each qa'idah or each maxim, see where it comes from, look at the wording of it, see where it comes from, and then take some other maxims that branch out of it, and then we see applications. We will see applications. This will give us a very good insight into fiqh, by the way. Will give us a lot of insight into fiqh. So as we study each qa'idah kulliyah, one of those big rules or big maxims, we will study underneath some of the lesser ones, the branch outs. We'll study some of those branch outs and show their utility as well, why they have branched out. Why don't we just keep them under the main rule? No, the branches as well, they give a different twist. Each one gives a different twist or different application. So we will, inshallah, focus on these. And we will try to take as many examples as possible and maybe try to apply some of the rules on issues that are relevant to, you know, the challenges we face today, inshallah. Okay, so I think that's enough for today. Inshallah, to next week we'll have a new start with al-Qawaid al-Fiqhiyya. But you need to go back to the book and do your own part of reading. So I didn't go over everything, I just touched on the main things, tried to put things in context. You need to read and find out for yourself the rest of it. The names of the books, the scholars, the historical development as well, how it developed. So we rushed through it, but you need to develop a bit more precise understanding of how it developed over the centuries. Any questions? Any questions? Yeah. The qawaid actually would not conflict with each other, but they might seem to be at some stage. What happens usually among the scholars, they call this at-tadakhul, where two rules with one case seem to overlap. In the sense, this case, or
Should we, يعني the scholars, that's the language of the scholars, they say, هل تخرج على هذه القاعدة أم على هذه القاعدة? This rule, does it apply to this or this case? Does it apply to this maxim or to this maxim? This is where the scholars sometimes differ. But the rules, as rules, they actually don't disagree. They're quite compatible. As we said, they actually signify and they are the fruit of this kind of systematic study of Islam. So they are quite compatible, especially for the normative ones, the bigger ones, and the ones that branch out of them. But for al-dawabit, we said they are madhab-specific. And sometimes they are area-specific, yeah, topic-specific. So these, when they are applied where they belong, there is no contradiction. Yeah. So there is a tadakhul, overlap sometimes, and there is also ta'arud. Sometimes they seem to be at a discrepancy, like they are conflicting with each other. But in reality, there's no conflict. Yeah. Where one ends, the other one starts. But where do we define this? This is where people could differ. That's the issue here. Questions? Nothing? Okay, if there are no questions, inshallah we conclude. So we'll meet next week. As I said, try to get the book. If anyone can like have it on their laptop or their tablet or even their phone, if it's a big screen, they can read from it. Inshallah we'll try to read from the book and then make comments. Jazakumullah khairan. صلى الله وسلم على نبينا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم وإياكم.